A5, number 10A.
So finally, one comes to the synonymous term love, and one begins to realize now, what's the purpose of all the six synonymous terms? Do they fulfill any purpose? Do they have any aim? And so love comes and says, yes. Everything that happens in the creative mind, which is unfolded through spirit, and therefore then identified in soul, and governed from the central principle, and being operated as the newness of life, and showing the actuality of being, is all there for one big purpose, to fulfill a universal plan. You have love as a plan of God, as the design of God, where love says nothing happens in that creative mind except what is preconceived in love as the plan of love, as the design of love. And therefore is all geared to the fulfillment of a purpose and of a aim. So you have love as plan, design, purpose, aim, fulfillment. That's all the tone of love, which says this is really love. Love is really that very faculty in being, in the one being that says nothing happens by chance. Everything is geared into a big plan, into a big plan. Not in a small plan, not in a plan of 70 years of earthly life. It's a terrific big plan that spans over centuries and centuries. And within that plan, love wants that everyone, everything finds its right place and finds its fulfillment. Therefore, love will gear everything into that plan. Will therefore enforce, love enforces, will enforce the operation of that plan in everyone, no matter if that one accepts it or resists it. Love is that enforcing power that enforces the plan of salvation for everyone. Love is salvation. And so one feels that love is that ability in being that wants perfection, that is perfection and wants to demonstrate perfection. That nothing that is imperfect can stand within the plan of love. And so love will just come to every situation and through soul reform it and reform it until finally the plan of love is being fulfilled and everything finds its perfection. Therefore, one feels that tenderness of love, that motherhood of love, that caring of love, that says in being there is something which cares for everything, for everyone, for every situation. It isn't so that God is far away and that we have to call down his blessing and have to make him work. Love is an atmosphere, is an aspect of being that is all over the place, that is universal, that wants to care for every detail, that every detail finds its fulfillment and its perfection. And that is the motherhood sense of it. The caring for it, the loving of it, the protection of it. Love is protection. Love doesn't want its idea to be destroyed. It will protect it, and so we don't have to protect an idea. The consciousness we have of love is the protection of an idea. We don't have to make protective work for anything. What we have to do is to be so attuned with the plan of love, the gentleness of love, the caring of love, the intensive desire of love to fulfill every idea, that this love protects every situation. We don't have to protect it. So love wants to bring everything to completion, to consummation. That's why love is expressed through these ideas like perfection, fulfillment, consummation. So when we rest within the consciousness of love, we see that every detail is being cared for. Therefore, love will meet every need, every human need, but certainly every spiritual need, every divine need. And as it is so engaged with every detail, we can see that the nature of love is really this. And again, I may have difficulty in expressing it, even if I would know English well enough, I would have difficulty. Love is that aspect in being which says the completeness and perfection of being is never without its manifestation. There is no possibility that principle is not expressed as its idea completely. That's love. When I see that principle can't, you see, I fall back on principle because love must be here principle. And when I see that principle cannot be without its inseparable manifestation as perfect idea, then I have touched love. Therefore, think of it, if we sit back and think about our human life and perhaps about our problems and about perhaps about how things will work out, and are they going to work out, and are they going to work out rightly and in time, that we just can sit back and see, if I ask that question, then I haven't seen love. Then I have no concept of true love, because true love says, in being, there is that office which says that the principle of being is always expressed as its idea and inseparable from that idea. That's love. Can you see how we get a sense of peace and of rest in love? Why should we have peace and rest? Or we are longing for peace and rest. Everybody is longing for peace and rest. And practically nobody gets it, though they are longing for it. Why don't they get it? Well, because they think they can start with love. They cannot start with love. They have to start with mind and spirit and soul and principle and life and truth. And then only their consciousness is really able to see that mind creates everything, and not me, and not my human mind. That spirit unfolds it, and not I have to go to unfold it and order it and outline it. That spirit will name it and bless it and identify it, not I will have to do something about it. I begin to see the principle operates by itself. And when principle operates by itself, that what is brought out is the isness of life and is existence and is the only existence there is, and that is the only factuality in being itself, then I say, okay, all is in order. All is at the point of fulfillment. Then I have peace and then I have rest. Because I've seen the whole range of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and then I have love, but not otherwise. So starting at the wrong end of the synonymous term will do nothing. We are building then just on terms and on concepts and affirming words and remembering words and speaking out words, but not a consciousness that is filled with the tonality of the seven synonymous terms. Then we feel at ease. And we say, okay, I see that in being, everything is what it is. And I feel at peace. So, yesterday we have tried to establish in consciousness the tonality of each synonymous term, so that we have a round tone of each one, and you could see that you can train that tonality by taking the list of ideas and ponder those terms and ponder how each term blends into the other terms within a synonymous term. And to see how this whole list of ideas, which in ordinary language don't have any synonymity, how they, in the language of spirit, have synonymity. They all belong to one synonymous term, and therefore do not contradict each other, but really demand each other, so that these terms are just giving one chain of meaning, one blending of meaning. Now, this is naturally something that each one has to culture for himself. He can't do that otherwise but just be quiet and still with himself and go over it and over it and over it until slowly the tonality is tangible to consciousness. Now, I want to go a step further, which would show you the method of investigating the synonymous term in the textbook, so that you understand the use of the synonymous term in the textbook. Namely, we want to consider how a certain definite idea of a synonymous term, whatever that idea is, how that idea naturally also blends with every synonymous term. It isn't so that those ideas which we have taken yesterday as belonging to a synonymous term stand by themselves, but each one of them blends and can be combined with every other synonymous term. That is already, therefore, a combination or a blending or a reflection, whatever you like to take as a technical term to express it. You see, like in arithmetic, we have not always just the three, or just always all over the page of four, but we are only introduced right at the beginning to the 10 digits. Once we know the 10 digits, then the textbook in arithmetic begins to compute and show the blending, the calculations with these ideas. Now, the textbook is written that way. Most of the textbook give us blendings of ideas with synonymous terms and various synonymous terms with the same idea. Therefore, in order to understand the textbook, we have to see the rules that are used by Mrs. Eddy in the use of the synonymous term. We do that best by taking concrete examples with the textbook. And so I want to take once the term power, because power is a term that lends itself very easily in the textbook to show the rules of combination. So we take up the combination of an idea with all the other synonymous term. That's the work of this morning. We take as an example power. And now we have to see that According to our research, power is an idea that characterizes mind. So whenever we think about power, we know that this is an idea that is a characteristic of mind and therefore belongs to mind as a specific idea. And so we know already at this point that mind is power, or the other way around, that power is mind. Well, if we take that as findings, then naturally we would see at once that we have found something quite helpful, quite powerful, namely that that power is not derived from any other source but the divine mind. Therefore, we can see that there is no power in anything else but in mind. And the moment I say that power is not from or in anything else but mind, I naturally bring up the question that the human mind believes that there is power in many other things than the divine mind. That there is power in death, that death is power. That hate is power. That people are power. That matter has power. And so I begin to realize that the problem that I have to deal with is to see how to offset these beliefs that there is power in many other things than the divine mind. Now, Mrs. Eddy tackles these problems. She will, in the course of her whole textbook, take up many beliefs in power and investigate them and correct them. Now, here we come to the point that we see that the counterfeit is ruling the use of the synonymous term. If the problem that is stated in the text is a counterfeit of any sort, the power of death, the power of hate, the power of envy, the power of personal government, the power of the human will, etc., that she will take up this proposition, which is a negative proposition, and will have to set it right. And in order to set it right, she must use the exact synonymous term that would counteract the belief. Therefore, we will see that Mrs. Eddy uses the term power in combination with all the seven synonymous terms. That she will speak about the power of mind, the power of spirit, the power of principle, the power of life, the power of truth, the power of love. She doesn't speak about the power of soul, but that is just by accident. She can't do everything within 600 pages, but we could just the same also speak of the power of soul in a definite circumstance. So in order to show you, when you read the textbook, how exact Mrs. Eddy's language is, we take a few references all on power, so as to show why and when she uses power in connection with one and when in connection with other synonymous terms. So we try to be very disciplined now, because when you have a whole class and everybody has to look up a reference in the textbook, we don't want to lose too much time. So please concentrate, so to say, on finding the pages and lines, and then we read together page and line and discuss it together, and in this way get a sense of the use of the term power. Page 143. 143, line 26, and I read, mind is the grand creator, and there can be no power except that which is derived from mind. So in the study of the synonymous terms, if we would come to this reference, we would ask now, what is the characteristic of mind? In the first line on 26, we would say, yes, here it is stated very clearly that the nature of mind is that he is the grand creator. So we would have written down creator. But in the second one, which is really here under consideration for us, we would see that there is no power except that which is derived from mind. Here we would see mind is characterized by that which is power and which is the only power there is. So this is a very clear statement that there is no power except that which is derived from mind. And we would find from this very statement that power is a quality or a characteristic of mind. Now, this is a very simple, clear, outspoken statement, so clear that we may not find it any more as clear as that. You see, the textbook is a symphony. Very seldom she will just tell what the synonymous term per se is. Usually her text is always combination. And only here and there one gets the crystal clear definition of the synonymous term, like here, that there is no power except that which is derived from mind. That tells us everything. It tells us that there is no power in anything else. No power in death, no power in hate, no power in people, no power in human government. It says exactly there is no other power except that which is derived from mind. So this would be a rather conclusive statement in our research. Now, let's take one or the other more. We turn to page 157, 157, line 8, again, I read here, Christian Science exterminates the drug and rests on mind alone as a curative principle, acknowledging that the divine mind has all power. Again, if we would study the synonymous term, we would come to this second mind here. The first one we will leave out because we are interested now in power. Acknowledging that the divine mind has all power. Again, we would feel, oh, this is very clear here. It shows that mind has all power. It says more than that mind is power, it really says it's all power, and would substantiate the first reference which we have read, that there is no power except that which is derived from mind. So would you feel that these two references would already give us a very clear, unquestionable sense that power is mind, or mind is power? Perhaps I take one or the other. More, we turn to page 443 to line 1. We have to read, it's a long sentence, so I read the beginning quickly because the point comes at the end of the sentence. I read, when the discoverer of Christian Science is consulted by her followers as to the propriety, advantage, and consistency of systematic medical study, she tries to show them that under ordinary circumstances, a resort to faith in corporeal means tends to deter those who make such a compromise from entire confidence in omnipotent mind as really possessing all power. If we ask ourselves what is now said about mind, we would say, well, here mind is expressed as omnipotent and further explained as really possessing all power. So again, we would feel this is a very clear-cut statement that mind has all power, is really possessing all power. So we add up to now already three clear statements. The first one was that all power is derived from mind. Then second, that mind has all power. And now third, that mind really possesses all power. So that we feel, yes, this is conclusive. We have to stop here quickly.